Welcome to the Brown Bagger on CFRO, where we feature many of the best speeches of Vancouver. As a freewheeling port city, Vancouver has the dubious distinction of being known for the sex trade. Since its foundation, prostitution has been a flourishing industry here, living in the shadows between law and sexual desire. This week, journalist and historian Daniel Francis, author of 20 books, including the Encyclopedia of British Columbia, takes us on a tour of his new book, Red Light Neon, A History of the Vancouver Sex Trade. We get vignettes of three periods from the early 1900s to more recent times. Daniel Francis finds the problems and attempted solutions haven't changed much, except to make the sex trade more dangerous for the men and women who make their connections in public places. Did a misguided police crackdown on sex bars, like Joe Filippone's penthouse nightclub, expose sex trade workers to street killers, to Robert Picton? Let's find out in this speech given at the Vancouver Public Library on March 20, 2007, in a recording made by the Necessary Voices Society.
I'd like to welcome you all here on behalf of the Vancouver Public Library and the Necessary Voices Society. My name is Loring Bohatch. I'm the president of Friends of the Vancouver Public Library. Popular historian Daniel Francis worked as a newspaper reporter before turning full-time to historical writing and research. He is the author-editor of more than 20 books, and he edited one of the most indispensable books about our province, the Encyclopedia of British Columbia, which went on to garner numerous awards, including the Roderick Haig Brown Regional Prize for Best Book About BC in 2001. One of his more recent books, A Road for Canada, The Illustrated Story of the Trans-Canada Highway, traces the history of the Trans-Canada Highway from its origins, conceived more than a century ago as a wagon road, to its present-day status as a crucial artery linking Canada from ocean to ocean. Dan has been highly involved with the local and national writing community, having served on the executive of the Writers' Union of Canada, the Vancouver Word on the Street Festival, and the West Coast Book Prizes Society. He has also served a term as president of the Federation of BC Writers. His current book, Red Light Neon, A History of Vancouver Sex Trade, sheds light on long overlooked archives and draws on personal narratives to show how commercial sex is a reflection of Vancouver's essential character. Please join me in welcoming Dan Francis.
Thanks very much. The book Red Light Neon is a history of prostitution in the city. I do reflect a bit on contemporary social and legal policies of today, but by and large, it's a history of the sex trade in the city from before the city's beginning down to the present. And I'm going to read for about 40 minutes, probably, from different parts of the book, basically from three different historical eras. So to give you a kind of flavor of what was going on in the city at different times. I'll start with the beginning. The city, as you probably know, was created in 1886. Before then, of course, it was the little mill town of Gastown, down in the Gastown Historic District. And the first prostitute was Bertie Stewart, supposedly opened a brothel down in Gastown in the 1870s. But the city, as I say, was created in 1886, and at its edge was the original Red Light District, which was on Dupont Street. We now know it as Pender, right at the entrance, the western entrance to Chinatown, right where the Chinatown Arch is. On Pender Street there was originally Dupont Street, and that was Vancouver's original Red Light District. So I'm going to start by reading about that. It was an unpaved street of two-storied clapboard buildings, some with balconies on their upper floors. At high tide, the waters of False Creek, then much larger than it is today, lapped at the foundations of the buildings on the south side of the street. During the day, Dupont Street was a bustle of Chinese vegetable vendors and drovers leading herds of cattle to the slaughterhouse at the other end of town. At night, the red lights winked on, and the wooden sidewalks filled with mobs of men in search of drink and companionship. In 1899, an investigation into police practices revealed that constables were accepting bribes, sharing the proceeds of fines, and otherwise turning a blind eye to the activities of the prostitutes. As a result, the police chief was fired, then quietly rehired. One madam who apparently lost her police protection was Florence McKenzie, known as Mother McKenzie, a white-haired, 65-year-old keeper of a house at 37 DuPont Street. In August 1899, she was charged with procuring and sentenced to 2 years in the provincial jail. This woman has been a prostitute in nearly every city on the continent, reads a note on the record book, and is one of the worst of her kind. In the summer of 1903, Mayor Thomas Nealon served notice that the houses on DuPont Street would have to move. These women certainly have to go, he told the Daily Province. The location of these houses is far too central to be allowed to remain now that the city is showing such a tendency to grow in that quarter. Progress was closing in on DuPont Street. But where would the houses go? The mayor refused to speculate, and in the end he was outvoted by his council, which agreed to postpone doing anything about the matter, instead leaving it to the police commission to handle. The majority of councillors recognized that if they forced prostitutes out of one area, they would probably move to other, even less acceptable neighborhoods. This is the beginning of what is a constant theme throughout the history of this subject in the city. Nonetheless, early in March the following year, that's 1904, city police raided several houses on DuPont Street as the first step in a campaign to close down the district. The brothel operators fought back. They hired lawyer W.J. Bowser, an influential conservative and a future premier of the province, to defend them in court, where they were charged under the provisions of the vagrancy bylaw. They chose to put forward Dora Reno, the owner of 140 DuPont Street, commonly known as the White House, as a test case. No one denied that the address in question was what was then called a house of assignation. Instead, Billy Bowser challenged the bylaw itself, arguing that it was ultra vires, in other words, that the city had no authority to pass the law in the first place. After deliberating for 2 weeks, the police magistrate agreed that the civic bylaw trespassed on the exclusive powers of the federal parliament and dismissed the charges against Reno and the others. And after that, the steam went out of the campaign to close down DuPont Street. Who were the women who engaged in prostitution in early Vancouver? A few details of their lives emerge only when they came into contact with the law. Some were very young. Annie Flack, for instance, was a 16-year-old girl from Germany who got 6 months in jail for being a common streetwalker. Lizzie Cook, 17, was an American seamstress who got 3 months for soliciting. Some were more experienced, like Julia Lebrun, the 40-year-old keeper of a body house at 130 DuPont, who took 30 days in jail instead of paying a $35 fine. Some were thought to be drug addicted, like Grace Cooper, who was called a hypofiend of the worst kind in the police records, who had a long list of convictions that included bank robbery, vagrancy, and streetwalking. Some were arrested for other crimes. Rosie Garland, a 19-year-old prostitute, supposedly from Paris, was sentenced to 18 months for stealing $60 from a man at the Dougal House Hotel. Rita King, a 20-year-old sporting woman, went to jail for 3 years for shooting another prostitute in a jealous rage at the Opera Resort Saloon. Eva Mack, an African-American from the U.S., was arrested for stealing $18. The report read, "This woman got G. Liskum to go into the alley, and while having connections with him, she stole his money." The court gave her 6 hours to leave town, a sentence meted out to many of the American women. The impression gained from such cases is that these were hard luck women forced by poverty, racial prejudice, and drug dependency into selling themselves in the streets and brothels. Their careers did not last long. Given the state of birth control, unwanted pregnancies were common. Back alley abortionists and self-administered remedies would have taken their toll in injury and death. Other occupational hazards included venereal disease, drug and alcohol abuse, and the violence of pimps and clients. One reason so many prostitutes were young was that so many did not survive to grow old. The issue of DuPont Street reemerged in 1906. A key factor seems to have been the presence of the Vancouver, Westminster, and Yukon Railway, a subsidiary of the Great Northern, an American line that had arrived from Seattle 2 years earlier. The VW&Y built its terminus on the south side of DuPont at the corner of Columbia Street. And its owners, who were miffed that passengers were disembarking into the heart of the city's vice district, added their considerable influence to the familiar complaints of the moral reformers. Early in June, Police Chief Sam North announced that he had told the DuPont Street madams to hunt for new quarters. There was much speculation in the press as to where the women would go. Would they move to Park Lane on the shores of False Creek on the southern border of Strathcona? Would they disperse to rooming houses along Granville, Hastings, and Main Streets, upsetting local businesses? The Daily Province revealed that, quote, the consensus of opinion is that the women will not be molested if they establish themselves in Chinatown. But the issue was a political hot potato, and both North and the mayor denied indignantly that they had arranged for a safe haven for the city's brothels. The Moral Reform Association joined the fray, insisting in a letter to City Council that the social evil is one which cannot in any way be sanctioned, being contrary to all laws of decency and morality. In the middle of this debate, Chief North was fired when one of the DuPont Street madams testified in court that she had paid him a bribe to leave her establishment alone. In August, his successor, C.A. Chisholm, announced a vigorous offensive against the brothels. I think I will not move against the women of the district, he said, but against the owners of the property in which they are residing. In that way, I will get at the parties who are reaping the real benefits of the traffic in high rentals which are being charged in such places. Not everyone believed that the police were as successful as they claimed to be in cleaning up DuPont Street. At the end of October, the license commissioner, William Hunt, paid an evening visit to Vancouver's Tenderloin. Strolling along not two blocks from City Hall, he found the brothels doing a brisk business. Young men loitered on the sidewalks. Red lights glowed above the doorways. Women in flimsy pink kimonos leaned out of the windows and beckoned to him as he passed. I think the conditions in the Tenderloin have not been so bad for the past 4 years, he reported. Chief Chisholm could only respond that the women were in the process of leaving the street. In August, there had been 41 brothels occupied by 153 prostitutes, he said. As of October, the number of women were down to 64. Early in November, the province reported that the last of the DuPont Street houses had closed. As Chisholm predicted, they did not move very far. Running south of off DuPont Street, just west of Carroll, were two dead-end lanes known as Canton Alley and Shanghai Alley, which you can, of course, still visit today. Until the 20s, they were the center of Vancouver's Chinatown. Only a block long, Shanghai Alley, a narrow dirt laneway, bustled with life. Residents occupied tiny rooms in the three-story tenements and rooming houses. Restaurants and laundries operated on the ground floor, along with the Sing Q Theater, a 500-seat space devoted to Chinese opera, theater, and public meetings. Parallel to Shanghai Alley was Canton Alley, more of a long courtyard. A variety of stores were at street level, with apartments crammed into the tenements above. A number of brothels opened in the alleys in the autumn of 1906, and the antagonism towards prostitution became mixed with the anti-Asian sentiment that was so strong in the city. Within a year of the crackdown on DuPont Street, 105 brothels were operating in Canton Alley and Shanghai Alley. Most of these would have been simple rooms rather than full-fledged houses. Chinese-run brothels imported young women from China, but also housed non-Asian women. In November 1906, a flood of American prostitutes washed into Canton Alley. Some of these women would have been refugees from San Francisco, where a devastating earthquake earlier in the year had destroyed much of the city's Tenderloin district and caused many of its inhabitants to move north up the coast to Seattle, Victoria, and Vancouver. Police raided the alley, and 32 women appeared in police court. The following is a description from the province newspaper. Garnet and Ruth and Daisy and Myrtle and Della and all the other 27 were Washington and Oregon birds of brightest plumage who had been partaking of the hospitality of the Canton Street nest for the past 2 months. Five women keepers were fined $50 in costs, inmates $35 in costs, piano players and housekeepers $25 in costs. The raids, said Chief Chisholm, were a gentle warning to the women to go back south of the border. One evening, a self-appointed delegation of civic officials toured the area with a reporter, and this is the part of the story from the province again. The party first visited Shanghai Alley, which at the time was crowded with boys and young men, gathered at the doors of the dens of vice, which have recently been located there. A long string of red lights told all too plainly the nature of the resorts. But some of the denizens have gone still further, and glittering name signs were displayed. But as though this was not enough, from behind the curtains and through the half-open doors, the women of the street could plainly be seen inviting passers-by to enter. As quickly as visitors to the place left, the occupants of the room, attired in the briefest of skirts and with décolleté apparel to the limit, took their choice from the waiting crowd about the door. There continued to be a lot of controversy in the city about where to locate the brothels. And eventually, talking now still about the pre-war period, eventually in 1912 they settled on a stretch of Alexander Street, which is east of Maine, north of Powell, down near the waterfront. Some of the houses are still in existence there today, but from 1912 up into the outbreak of World War I, this was Vancouver's red light district. A reporter for the newspaper The Truth paid a visit to Alexander Street. His report played to the widely held belief that Vancouver was becoming a West Coast Sodom. It described perfumed women in fancy dress strewn all over the street and men in the houses getting drunk on 25-cent glasses of beer and dancing all night to the music of, quote, a rather sunburned lady on the piano. It described the furtive Chinese housekeepers who collected the money and the hawk-eyed madams who raked in the profits. In the House of All Nations, the reporter discovered, quote, you can get everything from a chocolate-colored damsel up to a Swede girl. And there was certainly nothing clandestine about these operations. Again, quote, all the lights are blazing and the front door is open to all and sundry who have the money to spend. At some addresses, the names of the madams appeared in mosaic tile on the entranceway floors. Alexander Street, the article concluded, was never as open as it is now. Women operated most brothels of this period and sometimes even owned the houses. In a world that offered them few business opportunities, brothel keeping was an attractive proposition for women with a head for figures and a taste for the nightlife. Close to 45, prostitution had many venues and most of them were scruffier than the stereotypical brothel. A historian of New York City, Timothy Guilfoyle, catalogs a wide variety of facilities typical of large cities at the time. There were rooms above taverns, cigar stores, and barber shops. There were rooms in boarding houses and so-called houses of assignation where landlords provided space for short-term rental. There were panel houses where Confederates hid behind false walls and robbed clients while they were otherwise occupied. There were concert saloons, massage parlors, dance halls, and when nowhere else was available, dark laneways. Vancouver did not exhibit quite this range, but certainly the brothels of Chinatown and Alexander Street were just a taste of what was available. Professor John McLaren's analysis of arrest records provides a profile of the sex trade as it was practiced in the city on the eve of the First World War. Institutional brothels accommodated anywhere from 4 to 12 women, but the majority of prostitutes worked alone or in groups of 2 or 3, meeting their customers in hotels, rooming houses, or apartments. The women themselves were usually in their 20s and did not necessarily engage in prostitution full-time. Many had jobs as housemaids, waitresses, dressmakers, or in other low-paying positions and supplemented their incomes with sex work.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you are listening to BC historian Daniel Francis on his new book, Red Light Neon, A History of the Vancouver Sex Trade.
So that's a bit of a flavor of the situation in the city prior to World War I. I want to jump now to the interwar period, the 1920s, where I focus the story on a kind of the king of the underworld in Vancouver at that time. Joe Salona was his name. And he's particularly interesting because his career kind of intersects with the law enforcement agencies, also with the political leadership in the city, themes which are constant throughout the history of prostitution in the city. In 1919, just a few months after the end of the World War and the horrible influenza epidemic that followed, a 21-year-old Italian immigrant named Joe Salona arrived in Vancouver. Salona settled into the city's Italian community, clustered around Union and Prior Streets, east of Main. Soon he was running a market at the corner of Main and Kiefer in partnership with his friend Tony Lombardi. But storekeeping was apparently the least of Salona's enterprises. In 1922, he was convicted of keeping a brothel on Union. The next year, he was acquitted of assaulting a police officer. Salona was also reputed to keep one house that provided white women exclusively for Chinese customers. By 1926, he owned a pair of disorderly houses near Main, and when one of them was targeted by police, he turned it into a bootleg joint and moved his prostitutes to two rooming houses on East Hastings. Salona's criminal record was lengthening, and he was well on his way to becoming the notorious mayor of East Hastings, as journalists came to call him. In 1928, a member of the City Police Commission, T.W. Fletcher, made a series of sensational charges against the city's police force, claiming that officers were taking bribes from underworld figures. City Council appointed a local lawyer, R.S. Lenny, to investigate the allegations. During his inquiry, Lenny listened to 180 hours of testimony from 98 witnesses, much of it documenting the activities of Joe Salona. By this time, Salona was the undisputed king of Vancouver's underworld, and the Lenny inquiry was, in part, a response to fears that he enjoyed immunity from the law and was even subverting the elected government through his close relationship with the mayor, Louis Taylor, and the police chief, H.W. Long. Witness after witness was asked about the activities of Salona. "Every officer in the city knows him," declared Detective John Robertson. Robertson reported a conversation that he had with Chief Long, in which the chief told him that Salona had complained to Mayor Taylor about police harassment of one of his brothels. Long asked the detective to keep his men away from Salona's place, suggesting that the order originated with the mayor's office. On another occasion, Salona had bragged to an officer that he was good friends with Mayor Taylor and did not have to put up with police riding his joint. Another witness, Frank Cassisa, who ran brothels of his own, claimed to have met Salona in Taylor's company and even to have seen the mayor drunk at one of Salona's parties. Naturally, the newspapers splashed these supposed revelations across their front pages. For his part, Mayor Taylor told the inquiry that he knew Salona only as the shopkeeper who sold him his cigars, an unbelievable claim given weeks of contrary testimony. Nonetheless, when Commissioner Lenny issued his final report, he exonerated the mayor from any taint of wrongdoing. Taylor had never accepted a bribe, Lenny decided, nor had he interfered with the police on behalf of Joe Salona or any other felon. Lenny, who did not find the brothel keeper Cassisa to be a reliable informant, saw no reason to accuse the mayor of any crime or even to suggest that he resign. Still, the report came down hard on Mayor Taylor's judgment and administrative competence. It argued that the mayor's so-called open-door policy of going soft on vice crimes while encouraging police to go after violent criminals was responsible for confusion and low morale in the force. It also confirmed suspicions that Salona operated his brothels and his bootleg joints with impunity. Still, the report did not go along with the more alarmist charges that Vancouver was a city of unrestrained vice and immorality. Lenny sympathized with a police force that was understaffed and underpaid compared to those of other cities of comparable size and concluded that while there were problems, overall the force was doing a creditable job. Nonetheless, the Lenny Inquiry brought about the downfall of Taylor and Chief Long. In October 1928, less than 2 months after the inquiry made its report, Taylor entered a civic election campaign against the grocery tycoon William Malkin, who chose to run on the issue of police corruption. According to Malkin, the city was in the grip of a professional vice ring. The election, he said, was a fight for clean government and safe streets. The voters agreed. They swept the disgraced Taylor, who had already served 6 terms, out of office and installed a new regime with a mandate to clean house. Chief Long was busted down to traffic division, and all the members of his morality squad were suspended. For Joe Salona, however, business went on as usual. If anything, the Lenny investigation burnished his reputation. Now everyone had heard of the king of the body houses. By 1934, Louis Taylor was back in the mayor's office, and Salona had solidified his friendship with the new police chief, John Cameron. The mobster and the cop were seen sharing chicken and champagne while touring Howe Sound in the city's police boat. And Salona was known to be a regular visitor to the chief's home and office, where the pair allegedly engaged in drinking parties with booze supplied by a local bootlegger. At the same time, rumors again circulated that Mayor Taylor was mixing with the city's criminal class. Well-known theater manager Ivan Ackery, who used to manage the Orpheum Theater up on Granville, recalled the red necktie that was Mayor Taylor's trademark. "I always wondered," wrote Ackery, "whether it was his mischievous way of flaunting his sympathy for the city's prostitutes." To the extent that it existed, the cozy relationship between Salona and civic officials came to an abrupt end in 1935. Early that year, yet another law and order administration took office at City Hall. The new mayor was Jerry McGeer, already a prominent political figure. During the 20s, he had represented BC in contentious freight rate negotiations, and in 28, he was one of the lawyers who regularly attended the Lenny Inquiry hearings, making no secret of his belief that organized lawlessness has taken charge of this town. McGeer made vice one of the cornerstones of his campaign. According to him, Vancouver was in the hands of the crime bosses, notably Joe Salona, who ran their gambling joints and brothels while the police looked the other way. He promised, "I intend to expel the gamblers, racketeers, and vice mongers who are making our city a rendezvous for the criminal class." He easily defeated an aging Louis Taylor, whose claim that he had not been elected to run what he called a Sunday school city did not sit well with an electorate roused by alarmist rhetoric. Recognizing that the mayor meant business, Police Chief Cameron resigned. According to McGeer, the chief visited his house one night drunk, begging to keep his job, but McGeer wouldn't listen to him. Cameron was charged with corruption, though not convicted. Meanwhile, McGeer, who claimed to have been threatened by the city's mobsters, was followed everywhere by an armed police bodyguard. The following year, Salona, who was still limping from a gunshot wound in the hip inflicted by his wife Josie when she caught him in bed with another woman, this is got to be a movie, eh? Salona was charged with keeping a dozen young women at the Maple Hotel on East Hastings. In April 1935, Salona, just 38 years old, was convicted of procuring, living off the avails, and keeping a disorderly house, and sentenced to 22 years in jail, reduced to 12 on appeal. The prosecutor, Dougal Donaghy, told the court in his summation, referring to Salona, "He may be a clever Italian. He may have made a lot of money, but he slipped his foot when he took up his abode on the fourth floor of the Maple Hotel." I love that line. When authorities released Salona after he'd served less than half of his sentence, public protest was so intense that he was returned to the penitentiary to serve the remainder. In 1947, he emerged from prison, and for the rest of his life, he dabbled in bootlegging and gambling. He was no longer, quote, the sinister figure in the white slave rackets that he had been during the interwar period. But the journalist Jack Wasserman later noted that Salona was, quote, a rough customer who commanded fear among East Enders right up until his death, which occurred on March 4th, 1958. He was notoriously camera shy. Appearing before another inquiry into police corruption, In 1955, he punched a newspaper photographer who was attempting to take his picture. Those who knew Salona agreed that he was a man you didn't want to cross. Musician Austin Phillips, a habitué of East End night spots during the 30s, recalled Salona well. "That's a guy you couldn't even be decent with," he said, "and he was just a young man, but let go long enough, he'd have become another Al Capone." So that's Joe Salona, Vancouver's Al Capone.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you are listening to BC historian Daniel Francis on his new book, Red Light Neon, A History of the Vancouver Sex Trade.
I'm going to jump ahead now to the third period I want to talk about, which is the 1960s, 1970s. And, and relate to you the story of the Penthouse Cabaret and that famous trial that took place in the city at the time. I have to leap around a bit here, so forgive me if I get confused. By this point in the city, the brothel era had ended, and actually in terms of public, the public impression of prostitution in the city, it was a very quiet period, the 1960s. There wasn't a great deal in the newspapers about it. There wasn't a great deal of controversy as there would be in the 80s and 90s. And one of the strategies that that prostitutes had worked out was to work out of downtown bars, where they were welcome to carry out their business, not to conduct their business, but to meet their customers in these bars. And it was a fairly safe place for women to work off the street in conditions of somewhat conditions of secure conditions. I'll describe to you what happened then in 1975 that kind of disrupted this situation. Given the clandestine nature of the subject, it's no wonder that the history of prostitution is not well acknowledged in Vancouver. No historic plaques denote former brothels, though such buildings exist. No streets are named after famous streetwalkers. No statues raised to honor any of the city's many madams. But if someone asked me to identify a site where a tribute might be paid to the story of Vancouver sex workers, I would choose the corner of Seymour and Nelson and the neon-lit strip club that has been in business there for 50 years. During the 1960s and 70s, the Penthouse Cabaret was the city's most notorious night spot. Its owner, Joe Filippone, had bought the site along with his brothers in 1938. There, the family operated a string of businesses, including a delivery service and the Diamond Cab Company, though during the war, the brothers ran a steakhouse and an athletic club, and in the 50s, expanded the operation into a full-fledged nightclub. Before it received a liquor license, the Penthouse was a bottle club, of which there were several, of course, in the city at the time, where patrons served themselves discreetly from illegal bottles concealed under the table. It was a popular hangout with entertainers, newspaper types, and hangers-on who wanted a late-night drink, a bite to eat, and a chance to catch sight of a visiting showbiz celebrity. Harry Belafonte, Sammy Davis Jr., Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, many other top talents played the Penthouse. The actor Errol Flynn dropped in the night before he died at a West End apartment in the arms of his 17-year-old girlfriend. Joe Filippone was a bit of a local celebrity himself, known for his outspoken turn of phrase and a personal flair for fashion. One newspaper reporter described him, quote, "shaped like an egg, small, round, and smooth. A garnished egg, because Joe's wardrobe, orange shirt, brown checked jacket, green plaid pants, and patterned tie, looks as if it was pulled at random out of a spin dryer." By the 60s, Filippone's club was a flourishing center of prostitution. As many as 100 women worked out of the club every evening. It was a convenient and safe place to meet customers and make dates, and various people profited from the setup. A prostitute entering the club paid a $2.95 cover charge, more if she were returning after a trick, plus a $2 tip for the doorman and the maitre d'. She sat at a reserved table for which she tipped the hostess $2. Other tips were paid to anyone who sent a customer her way. The club made cash advances available to patrons wishing to use their credit cards to pay for a prostitute at a 20% surcharge. Taxis lined up three deep on the street to carry the women and their customers to the nearby hotels. In the unlikely event of a police raid, the women were alerted by an announcement over the public address system, "Mrs. Finley has arrived." When management spotted a woman talking to an undercover cop she had not recognized, she was called away to the telephone. The police, some of whom were regular visitors, knew full well what was going on at the penthouse and other clubs like it. For the most part, they tolerated it as a nuisance-free alternative to streetwalking. Then in December 1975, police raided the penthouse and a second club, the Zanzibar. Why authorities decided to shut down the clubs at this particular time, when prostitutes had been working there for so long, is not clear. As the Sun newspaper columnist Alan Fotheringham pointed out, quote, "The hooker shop known as the penthouse has been existing for decades. It's been known as one of the landmarks of the town, a minor league equivalent of the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building." Whatever the reason, the police launched an investigation using photographic surveillance and a young female constable posing as a prostitute. Satisfied they had the evidence they needed, authorities laid charges against Joe Filipponi, his brothers Ross and Mickey, a doorman, and two cashiers, alleging conspiracy to live off the avails of prostitution, corrupting public morals, and keeping a common body house, as well as bookmaking and recording bets. As for the Zanzibar, the case never came to trial. The club burned down, and though the owner was charged with arson, he was not convicted. During the penthouse trial, which began in September 1976 and was not concluded until March of the following year, the Crown alleged that the club used the presence of prostitutes as a drawing card to attract customers and made money from the operations of the women who did business on the premises. Lawyers for the penthouse argued that the owners could hardly be held responsible for everything that went on in their club and pointed out that the women did not share their proceeds with management or turn tricks on the premises. The trial continued for 61 court days and featured sometimes sensational testimony that kept the city memorized. It was dubbed the Charge Sex Trial after the Charge X credit cards that many patrons used to buy sex. One prostitute appeared on the witness stand disguised in a wig and dark glasses and refused to identify her pimp who was sitting in the courtroom for fear she would be beaten. A pair of schoolgirls told the court how they had visited the penthouse, hoping to turn a trick. A fresh-faced police recruit named Leslie Schultz had her picture splashed across the front pages when she recounted her activities, posing as a prostitute in the cabaret. In his own defense, Joe Filipponi compared the penthouse to a Lonely Hearts Club. Quote, "It was just a question of boy meets girl," he told Judge William Traynor with a straight face. But the judge found five of the defendants guilty of conspiring to live off the avails. Mickey Filipponi got off, fined them, and sentenced Joe and Ross to 60 days in jail as well. In December, however, the BC Court of Appeal overturned the convictions. After a brief argument with the civic government over renewing its license, the penthouse reopened, though its days as a celebrity-filled night spot were over. The police undercover operation and the legal proceedings had cost taxpayers $2 million. By closing the penthouse, the police precipitated the most tumultuous period in the history of Vancouver prostitution. In retrospect, everyone agreed that the closure was a major mistake. The decision caused an increase in the number of women on the street, which led to the muddled attempts in the 1980s to clean up the West End, which is another episode described in the book, and led as well, indirectly, to the tragedy of the missing women. One of my police informants recalling this period said it was, quote, "almost like the Dark Ages settled in over the streets as far as prostitution was concerned." He meant, I believe, that by hassling the women and their customers, police drove the sex trade deeper into the shadows, creating the conditions in which predators could flourish. To be fair, the police did not get much help from local politicians, who catered to the not-in-my-backyard prejudices of neighborhood groups. If there was a moment when things went sadly wrong with the city's attempt to regulate commercial sex, a good case can be made that it was here at the penthouse in 1975. Prostitution offers an unusual perspective on the history of the city's politics, social geography, criminal underlife, and moral atmosphere. Unhappily, the story does not show Vancouver in a positive light. This book is a history of hypocrisy. The city's political and social leaders consistently have treated prostitutes as pariahs whose presence was tolerated, sometimes exploited, but never approved. All the while, the authorities collected millions of dollars in fines and license fees from businesses that everyone knows were and are fronts for the sex trade. Sex workers have never lacked for customers. What they have lacked is a secure place to conduct their business. A vast off-street sex trade flourished while police, at the urging of politicians vowing to purify the city, concentrated their attention on the comparatively small number of street prostitutes who worked out in the open. Because they were considered a nuisance, these sex workers were hounded from street to street and neighborhood to neighborhood. Laws were adjusted to criminalize their activities. New ways were found to disrupt their business. These efforts salved the conscience of the morally righteous, but each attempt to discourage prostitution simply forced the women to work in increasingly dangerous circumstances. The end result is the rising death toll that we have seen in the past 3 decades. So that completes the sections that I wanted to read from. I think the last section gives you some idea of the arc of the argument that I make in the book. And I trace some of these themes, as I mentioned, through the different historical eras of the city. So certainly I'd be more than willing to answer any questions or perhaps more importantly, hear your own views on the subject. But thank you very much for coming out. Yes?
So you mentioned the penthouse being raided in 75. Between 65 and 75, I lived in the West End. And from about 70 to 75, I think it's Harris Street, the first street down south from Bellow. Anyway, on the one side there, Trailer Conservatory, there was a concrete building which was obviously being used by prostitutes, and it was being patronized by a police car parked there quite often, and the police seemed to be very friendly with the girls. So I'm just wondering if the penthouse way wasn't a bit get rid of the competition.
I don't know. One theory, I think it was Fotheringham, who suggested that it was because there was a new police chief in town who wanted to establish his credentials. Another theory was that Joe Filipponi and the head of the vice squad were having some kind of a rivalry going on. So in order to punish him, the vice squad decided to raid. And that was confirmed by one of the policemen I talked to who was in the force at the time. But, you know, so there were these kind of reasons. So you would have been in the West End just prior to when all the big...
I moved down June 75.
Because when the police flushed the women out of the bar, and it wasn't just the penthouse, as I say, it was the Zanzibar, but every bar who was allowing women to work on the premises would have taken notice of this and would have cut back on these activities. So it flushed hundreds of women out onto the street, and this was really the beginning of a period of great turbulence surrounding this issue in the city. And one area that women established themselves was on Georgia, outside of the old hotels there in the nightclub district on the corner of Georgia and Hornby and Howe, and the downtown business people were all up in arms. The hotel owners were all up in arms and so on. So the police came down fairly strong there after a couple of years. And then Davy Street developed from the late 70s. Along a stretch of Davy Street and that whole West End, if any of you remember that, were living in the city at the time, the whole trouble in the West End over that time, which is a very complicated and long process and gets a whole chapter in the book. But basically it went on for several years and spawned, and it was really ugly. I mean, transvestites and gays were also active in the area, and homophobes were driving by and throwing bottles of urine at people, and sort of neighborhood groups had their own quite legitimate concerns about noise and so on. So quasi-vigilante committees were created, and there was a real possibility of violence taking place on the street. The city tried to do what it could by passing various bylaws, but these were declared ultra vires again by the court, a throwback to that period in 1904 in the city. And then finally, in, I think it was 1985, the provincial court justice passed an injunction basically banning prostitution from the West End. And of course, all that did was force prostitutes east of Burrard and then east of Granville into other strolls, and then the whole thing starts up again in Mount Pleasant in the late 80s and then in Strathcona. So basically it's a story of not having ever figured out in the over 100 years of the city's history how to deal with this issue. Yeah?
Where does your book end? Is the chapter with the penthouse where you...
No, I do. There's a chapter on a kind of chronological account of the missing women leading up to the arrest of Robert Picton, legal changes during the 80s, and then really up to that parliamentary committee that made such a disappointing report last year. So it comes up reasonably close to the present, but has nothing. I have nothing to reveal about the trial or anything like that. Yeah.
Do you mention anything about some of the prostitute activists like Sally DeQuadros and the Alliance for the Safety of Prostitutes or anything like that?
No, allusions to that during the 80s period in the West End and in Mount Pleasant, the way some prostitutes organized to fight back. Yeah, just a bit. Yeah.
Do you male prostitution at all?
Not a great deal.
No.
Not a great deal. A bit, again, in the 80s. On the West End, but I was unable. This wasn't an area that I was able to get into. Yeah.
Do you go in any great depth about the connection between the narcotics trade and the prostitution in Vancouver?
No, again, not a great deal, except to note that the connection becomes from the 70s becomes much closer than it had been historically, and adds that a whole new dimension to the story. Yeah, sure. Certainly, drugs are nothing new in Vancouver to the 70s, but that seems to be when drug addiction seems to be the main factor that people are referring to. I should mention that, you know, in this subject, 80% of prostitution takes place off the street. Usually that figure is used, 15 to 20% on the street. Much of what I write about in the book is the story of street prostitution, because it's the side of the issue that is causing problems for authorities, and so it's the most public side of prostitution. But ironically, it's also the smallest number of people engaged in it in the city. So no, I mean, I know, I've talked to people who were down... people who worked in logging camps and came into the city in the off season and so on, and lived in rooming houses on the downtown east side and stuff. And heroin, and this is the late 40s and 50s, and heroin was widely used among loggers and other people at that time. But interestingly, the particular guy who was talking about that didn't seem to think that it was widely used among the women. But that's sort of a whole other subject, the history of the drug trade in the city, a fascinating one. Yeah.
Having looked at Vancouver's attitudes over that really long period of time, do you have any comment on what you see as sort of the social or political climate now, or attitudes?
Well, it's kind of depressing because in a sense nothing changes. In a sense, everything changes. I mean, the missing women and the period from the 70s is a very dark chapter. Nothing like this has ever happened in the city before, obviously. So we have to think about why. But in the other sense, there's this continuum of attitudes towards prostitution. On the one side, of course, you have people who wish to eradicate it altogether, either because they find it immoral or from a feminist perspective, they find it oppressive by definition of women. So they can't see any way in which the state should condone prostitution at all. And that poll has been constant ever since the city began. And on the other end are people who don't think it belongs, don't think it should be criminalized at all, who want to decriminalize or legalize the activity, either regulated through government licensed brothels or whatever, or just get out of the law altogether. And then there are people in the middle, and it just moves back and forth, you know, through the history of the city. And it's just you see those arguments played out now in the popular press, basically the same arguments, it seems to me, as you saw 100 years ago. At the same time, I think it's wrong to say that nothing has changed. I think, for one thing, that 100 years ago, no one would have considered asking a prostitute what her opinion was about the law or what was going on in the city. Whereas I would think any sensible person now would not think of not asking. So that there is a process, what's it called, the living communities. There's a process going on in the city of consultation with people involved in the sex trade, with neighborhood groups, with local politicians, trying, it seems to me, finally to be working out some kind of consensus, building some consensus, and trying to find a solution to how neighborhoods and the sex trade can coexist. At the same time, you know, you see that report that the parliamentary committee came out with, I guess, last fall, in which they basically took the stance, the conservative members of the committee anyway, took the stance that the state could not condone prostitution in any form. It was oppression of women, and therefore they just threw up their hands and said they weren't going to do anything. Even though they admitted all the way through the report that the state of the law was part of the problem, they seemed to conclude that there was nothing they could do about the law. So, you know, if you look in one direction, you could be pessimistic. You look in another, and you can be optimistic.
I like the way in your conclusion you talked about how the city was always happy to take revenue in the form of fines or business license. When did they start dipping in the form of business license revenue collection? Was that the 70s?
Gee, you know, I don't know. I don't know when that would have started.
The official time, when it turned over from that kind of fine.
Yeah, before it was bribery.
Hey, come in, fill in your business.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when that started. Certainly, in the early period, bribery was just, it was open. It was accepted. I mean, in that committee, the police never made apologies for taking money from brothel keepers. In fact, it wasn't a case of, there must have been cases where individual policemen were pocketing the money, but officially, it was the way they collected money for their social committee. They took bribes from the prostitutes to leave them alone. They would openly phone when every once in a while they had to make a bus. And I'm talking about the 20s and 30s, the period of Joe Salone. When they felt it necessary for public relations or whatever to make a bus, they would phone ahead and warn everybody to clear the place out because the police were coming. And then they would take their kickbacks and they would put it in the social fund in the police department and use it to fund what, the annual Christmas party or something like this. And this was described at that inquiry in 1928. Nobody was apologizing for it. I think it was just the way things were done. So that was an informal kind of licensing that was going on, I guess.
Do you expect there to be any increase in 2010?
I don't know. There would be an increase with an increase of the number of people, one assumes.
Well, I mean, lots of people out of town,
that's right. Yeah, so it would be interesting to see how the authorities figure on responding to that.
I don't suppose we've had enough policing to.
That it'd be nice to think that by 2010, maybe there might be some changes to the law that would improve the situation.
We've seen the revenue that Georgia Strait will make in the ads, and you will.
Yeah.
That's another part of a thing about raising who makes money.
Just wondering what inspired you to write the book.
Well, I'd written an earlier book a couple of years ago about Mayor Taylor, who I read about earlier. in 2004, I guess it was. It's called L.D., Mayor Louis Taylor and the Rise of Vancouver. And so the story about the Lenny Inquiry and his connections to vice in the city and his interesting ideas about vice. Taylor was considered soft on vice because he didn't think the police should get too excited about it. So even though I read sections there about his close connections to the underworld and stuff, he was considered soft on vice, and he was always, people who wanted to, who ran against him, were continually bringing that up in campaigns. He was Vancouver's longest serving mayor. He served 8 terms, total of 11 years. So because of his connection to the subject, it sort of presented itself as another subject for me to pursue since I'd done much of the work already. So that's where the idea came from. So thank you very much for coming. There's books for sale over in the corner there, and I'm going to be over with a pen signing them if anybody would like to buy one. But I thank you very much for coming, for being such an attentive audience. Thank you.
You have been listening to BC historian Daniel Francis on his new book, Red Light Neon, A History of the Vancouver Sex Trade. This talk was at the Vancouver Public Library on March 20th, 2007. Our thanks to the Necessary Voices Society for providing this recording. Find more of their speeches at their website, www.necessaryvoices.org. And that's it for this week on The Local Brown Bagger, brought to you by CFRO, Co-op Radio 102.7 FM on your dial. You can listen to CFRO anytime on the web by going to cooperadio.org. The station is also available anywhere in British Columbia by cable. Just check the listings of your local provider. And you can tune in by the Star Choice satellite on channel 845. Co-op Radio is funded by you, the listener. If you enjoyed this program, please consider becoming a member to help us pay the bills. Our programmers are all volunteers, but we need the building, the transmitter, and a small staff to keep the station going and provide you with alternative voices you won't hear anywhere else. You can join by calling 604-684-8494 or on the web at www.cooperadio.org. Keep us going and come back next week for another fine speech from Canada's fabulous West Coast.
Así celebraban los seguidores del presidente Hugo Chávez tras la proclamación del triunfo del mandatario venezolano en las elecciones presidenciales.
South America rising. After many years of U.S. domination, Latin American countries are asserting themselves. Hear Noam Chomsky on the rise and fall of American domination and a discussion by a group of South American activists on the rise of participatory movements in Latin America. Mark your calendar. Join us Wednesday, April 25th, 12 noon to 2 p.m. for this special radio presentation by Noam Chomsky on the People's Radio Station, CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
The devil is right at home. The devil himself is right in the house. Yesterday, the devil came here, right here, and it smells of sulfur still today.